Hello, boys and girls of Credit Union Land, and welcome to the first episode of Season 2. That is right, we are back with Episode 54 of the CU Insight Experience, and it's a good one. This episode is brought to you by our friends at Co-op Financial Services. Co-op is your trusted payments processing partner whose mission is to drive the credit union movement forward, and we could not be happier to have them on as a sponsor for the podcast. My name is Randy Smith, and it is my job on the show to have conversations with the best and the brightest of the credit union community. I get to pick their brains and see if we can't find a few nuggets that we can all learn from. My guest on today's show is the Honorable Rodney Hood. He was nominated and confirmed in 2019 as the 11th chairman of the NCUA. We had a wide-ranging conversation about his goals for the NCUA under his chairmanship and what he sees as the opportunities and challenges for credit unions in the future. We also talked about DEI and financial inclusion and why this is so important for him personally, as well as the NCUA and the credit union system as a whole. As always, we got into the leadership and life hacks section of the show and wrapped it all up with those rapid fire questions. There's a few new questions I've added to the mix for 2020. This was a lot of fun to record, and what better way to kick off season two than with Chairman Hood. So without further ado, I give you my conversation with the Honorable Rodney Hood. Enjoy. Chairman Hood, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you, Randy.
I've been really looking forward to this. I so appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule. You've been running all over the place. Our paths have crossed a few times, but you've been nonstop. So there were so many directions we could go, but I did want to, you know, just start off kind of big picture, you know, the future of credit unions and your long-term vision for your chairmanship at the NCUA. You know, what are the biggest challenges you see credit unions facing today, and what is the NCUA doing to help there?
Oh, I like that question. And first and foremost, Randy, thank you for giving me an opportunity to join you on today's podcast. It's been now, I'm approaching my eighth month as chairman of the National Credit Union Administration. And before I answer your question about the challenges, I think it's fitting and appropriate that we talk about where we are to date. And where we are to date is credit unions are strong, vibrant, and they're contributing to the day-to-day success of the American economy. Today's credit union system serves 119 million members around the United States. That's roughly one-third of America has a credit union account. And so developing our credit union system, I'm also pleased to know that credit unions now have assets that approximate $1.5 trillion. And in addition to that staggering rate, we have a very solid and robust share insurance fund that insures all of our deposits. And that rests now at $16.7 billion, and it's still growing. And what I like as a safety and soundness regulator is I like to look at the capital. Is it adequate to keep our credit union safe and sound? The credit union capital level now is at 11.39%. And just to give you all and your listeners a view of what that means, a well-capitalized credit union is typically considered well-capitalized at the statutory level of 7%. So we today are sitting at over 400 basis points, or 4% above the statutory requirement. It's because the credit union system is so strong that I really have every belief that we can continue to provide opportunities for the members to get access to affordable financial services and products. Credit unions are lending money daily for folks to have access to sustainable mortgages to provide shelter for their families, to get affordable auto loans so they can have the cars to drive to and from work, but more importantly, to also get access to the college loan so they can educate their children and prepare other contributors to our economy. So I want you to know that the credit union system that I have come a part of today is strong, and my regulatory philosophy is to make sure that our regulations remain effective, but simply not excessive. So those are the things that I want to continue to see, those positive growth trends, and for us to continue to have such stellar results. But with that being said, I do recognize that there are challenges that we need to address as well. In fact, when I think of some of the challenges in the financial services industry, I think the main one is the financial technology sector is creating a different type of challenge in the form of new ways of doing business and also new customer expectations. It is critically important that we plan and prepare for these changes because they're here. And believe you me, there's more on the way. Let's go down the list of things that have come into the financial services arena just since I was last at the agency well over a decade ago. Mobile banking, remote deposit capture, digital payments, artificial intelligence, data aggregation, or whatever may be lurking around the corner next week, like a Libra, something like that. We know that these trends are going to change the way you as credit unions engage with your members, the way you all analyze lending risk, and the way you market and deliver your products and services. You're certainly not alone in facing these challenges. These technological changes are creating challenges for regulators like me as well. So we all need to be prepared. What I want to emphasize on the podcast today, Randy, is that when I talk about these challenges, is that we should not approach them simply as things to be feared or avoided, but as opportunities for credit unions to better serve their members, their employees, and the communities that they serve more effectively. The threat of a data breach, I recognize, is a real and scary thing, but it's also an opportunity to focus on improving security practices and providing the highest level of protection to the credit union's members, data, and those are the things in the assets. So those are critically important things.
In the first season of the podcast, it was kind of a back and forth. When I started it, I had this mindset that like technology could be the great equalizer for credit unions. And then going through the course of the year, I'd almost say it was 50-50, right? Like where some people are like, but it's expensive and it's hurting small credit unions. So it's an interesting time that we live in.
It's a delicate balance.
It really is. It really is. You know, something else, and we were talking about this a little bit before we went on the air, was end of last year, you held a workshop, I guess you could say, on DEI. And I know that's something that's very important to you. And that's been something I've really tried hard to keep front and center on the podcast and have conversations about it. So I would ask you a couple of questions. Number one, why is that important to you? And why is it important to credit unions and the NCUA overall?
What a timely question. Well, I must say the issue of diversity, equity, and inclusion, those items are important to me for a number of areas. First and foremost, I have spent the better part of my career working in community development banking, where I've taken it as a special interest in helping vulnerable, marginalized communities have access to affordable capital. How do we make sure that the training systems are there, the opportunities for financial counseling, financial coaching? So those are activities that I've long worked with, again, because it really undergirds diversity, equity, and inclusion by promoting shared prosperity and financial access. And I think it even goes for me a little deeper than that. First and foremost, I am, in fact, the first African-American chairman of a financial banking and regulatory agency. With that comes a lot of responsibility. With that comes another belief that I have, and that is financial inclusion is the civil rights issue of my time. And it's because of that being a pressing civil rights issue, it really for me means that more needs to be done to promote equity, diversity, and inclusion. For me, these discussions, though, of diversity, inclusion, and equity are simply more than abstract ideals. There's something that I believe needs to also be reviewed and considered a business and strategic imperative. You mentioned that we did just host NCUA just hosted the first ever DEI summit. We did it not because it's going to allow credit unions to check a box, but we did it because we want credit unions to be able to respond to the shifting demographic trends that we're seeing around growing communities of color, also seeing a heightened demand for financial products for low to moderate income communities. And another group that I believe is critically important when we look at diversity, equity, and inclusion is a group that really doesn't have a voice, and those are disabled households. When we think today that 40% of Americans cannot have the resources to meet the needs of a $400 emergency, that is an issue. That number from the Federal Reserve grows even more exponentially to 60% for households with disabilities. So that means that more needs to be done around financial inclusion and it being a civil right. But we at NCUA, again, we are wanting credit unions to know that we want them to embrace diversity, equity, inclusion. We want them to have that reflected in their boards of directors. We would like to see credit unions have boards that reflect the diversity of the community that they serve. We'd like for them to have that in the employment base as well. We'd also like for them to see that with their suppliers and diversity. And when I, as a regulator, I don't ask credit unions to do things that we as an agency are not doing ourselves. So I'm not just giving platitudes and saying, you guys go out and take my admonishment, but I'm saying that we at NCUA are doing those things. So what are we doing? We are doing a lot of hiring. We're promoting and hiring interns from low to moderate income communities, from ethnic communities, from disabled communities to come and work with us as internships so they can learn more about not only just careers in the credit union system, but perhaps in the broader financial services this arena as a whole. We're also, OMWI, the Office of Minority Women Inclusion, that group reports directly to me as chairman under Dodd-Frank Section 342. That group is helping us make sure that we have suppliers who are diverse. At NCUA, of all of our overall contractual spending, 44% of that, I'm proud to say, is going to organizations and companies that are diverse and minority owned and operated. So not only am I telling credit unions to do that, but I'm letting you all know that we're doing it as well. I've also tasked our agency with recruiting more at some of the underserved communities. How do we go to the community groups? How do we work with maybe some of the civil rights groups like the National Urban League, National Council of La Raza? Those are the types of things that I think it makes sense. If you're going to support diversity, equity, and inclusion, when you have those tangible results that I've just been able to enunciate, it shows that it's more than lip service. It shows that it's more than checking a box. But to me, it's a business and strategic imperative. And if I may, Randy, one of the things that I really want to do is I want to encourage our credit unions to fill out the diversity survey. And in order to know where we're going as an industry, where we're going with the credit union system as a whole, I can't know where the strength and growth opportunities are if the credit unions are not filling out the diverse surveys. And I want them all to know as I speak to the podcast, those are anonymous. No one is going to come and play gotcha. It has nothing at all to do with your examination or any of your risk ratings. But again, we want to show movement. We want to move the needle and things of that nature to show, are we attracting folks in our workplace? I'm proud that NCUA is attracting diverse individuals. With that being said, it's not simply enough to have diversity around the table and make sure then people think that they all are there equitably. It means having a culture that fosters that diversity. And that's why I am pleased to announce that I created a NCUA Culture Council, where people who are from diverse backgrounds can have opportunities to come and talk about what are they wanting to work on, what are the growth opportunities. We also have what we call enterprise employee resource groups. So those are groups where people by affinity can get together and continue their career trajectory to have career opportunities. But again, it's not simply enough to bring people diverse and call it diversity and then say it's accomplished. But again, it takes the cultural sensitivities. And that's why, as a man of color, I'm sensitive to making sure that these are the things it takes to really be holistic and all-encompassing. And if done right, companies and organizations like credit unions and groups, if you're doing diversity, equity, and inclusion correctly, people who work for you and with you will bring their true, authentic selves to work each and every day.
Oh, I absolutely love that. And then it sounds like you're walking the walk, right? As Jerry Jones would say. So not just talking the talk. I absolutely love it. Something that I really have learned over the course of the year, and I have to give full credit to Jill on this one, was, and you mentioned it when you talked about the hiring practices and the idea that if you recruit the same way that you've always recruited, you're going to get the same people, right? So like working with community groups and, you know, to find more diverse candidate pools and encouraging people to apply, right?
Idea. Why don't you go where the diverse people are?
Right, exactly. I appreciate your leadership in this. And again, thank you for being willing to talk about it today. The follow-up question that I have on that, and my guess is I know your answer to this, but I still want to ask it. Is this something that to see that needle move, we need to do from a systemic level, like through the system? Is it individual credit unions? Is it us as individuals? Or is it all three?
Above. It is all of the above. It is a true ecosystem. No one person can say that they're solely responsible for diversity, equity, and inclusion. Now, of course, it's like having a chief risk officer of a credit union. Well, that chief risk officer is not the sole person who is mitigating and managing risk. Similarly to diversity. Yes, we have someone who handles diversity, and each of the credit unions probably have someone in HR. But at the end of the day, we each have a responsibility for using our network and to find ways of sourcing and bringing in diverse talent. And as you heard me mention earlier, Randy, I look at diversity through a lens that is a little broader than most. We tend to only think of ethnic minorities, but I'm thinking of also low to moderate income individuals and another group, and that would be disabled populations, individuals who may have a disability but who still want to work. And how do we work with groups such as Gallaudet University here in Washington, D.C., not that far from where we're sitting right now with you, where they have organizations that can help these individuals who are deaf and hard of hearing seek gainful employment. In fact, I've worked with organizations that have hired some of these individuals as accountants and as technicians. So how do we also work with American Council of the Blind? So again, I'm trying to get credit unions, and I'm also work with NCUA to just make sure that when we are talking about diversity, that we're being broad and inclusive, even in who comprises it.
It's interesting to me. I was just over the weekend reading an article about the travel industry having a huge problem because of, like, it's just not prepared for the amount of people that have disabilities with an aging population. And they were even talking about it from the workforce standpoint, right? Exactly. So it's not just credit unions. That's something that we have to be working on. If we were to sit down a year from now, what is it that you're most proud of that you've accomplished?
If we were to sit down a year from now, which I hope it's not going to be that long that I get the pleasure of your company again. But with that being said, I would like to go back to the fact that I am trying to create regulations that are effective and not excessive, that a year from now, I'd like for some of the policies that we're making, some of the rulemakings that we're having, are empowering credit unions to serve their members more effectively, such as the payday alternative loan that we as a board just announced at the last board meeting. There is going to continue to be a demand for short-term small-dollar loan products, especially for those individuals who cannot collectively come up with a $400 emergency loan. Because of that, I want to continue to create opportunities for individuals, not just to get small dollar loans in an emergency, but are we creating an ecosystem where there's financial counseling, financial coaching? Am I creating opportunities for credit unions to use financial technology constructively, strategically to mitigate those cybersecurity risks we may have talked about earlier, but are they using it around financial inclusion and accessibility? So that's what I'm hoping a year from now, that we are helping improve credit scores through things like our alternative payday loan product. And in addition to that, are we creating economic prosperity for individuals who perhaps have been left out of the workforce, meaning my Second Chance initiative that was recently also launched by the NCUA board? There are over 66 million individuals, according to the last study that I saw, where individuals have had nonviolent criminal offenses on their records. And even though they have paid their debt to society, they've paid the fine, they've already gotten it off the record for the most part, but yet they still have the scarlet letter where they're not able to work at insured federal credit unions. Through our Second Chance initiative, these individuals will now have opportunities to seek not just meaningful and gainful employment at a federally insured credit union, but that means that they will also now have access to financial resources such as loans, financial coaching, counseling, and it's going to continue to give them that lift on the economic ladder and bring them a step closer to the shared prosperity that many pockets of American society are facing today.
I've mentioned this on the podcast before. When I was going through my DE class, we were supposed to go out and mystery shop credit unions and banks and just see what the experience was like, but it happened to be a bank holiday. So we ended up going to payday lenders. And what I've mentioned before was I was amazed on how welcoming and you didn't feel like an outcast and things like that. And that's something we've talked about before on the podcast. And I love what you're talking about is the idea that if someone needs a second chance, they need that short-term loan, if they, whatever it happens to be, to welcome them in, not like shun, you know, like so that they feel bad, like embarrassed to come in and ask for it. It was a really eye-opening thing for me to do that, where it was like, wow, this was easy. right? You know, but type of thing.
Credit unions should follow that model. In fact, no, I'm not going to say the credit unions should follow that model.
No, right? Yep.
Credit unions created that model. When I talk about the model, not of usurious loans, but credit unions of people helping people.
Absolutely.
That's been embedded in their ethos since the credit union exception, not for profit, not for charity, but for service.
Yes.
It's credit unions live each and every day. So when I talk about creating opportunities for financial inclusion and innovation and access, credit unions, I think, I dare say, are better positioned than any other financial services providers because they know their members. And because of the point that you raised about you're walking into the doors of the pernicious payday lender, well, they may have been welcoming, but they are not welcoming when these folks aren't able to build their credit report.
Absolutely not, right?
And with that new payday alternative loan rule that we have at NCUA, we did away with the provision that a member would have to be a part of that credit union for 30 days as opposed, so we've now made it so on day one that you're eligible to join the credit union, you get the loan, because most people don't have the luxury of waiting 30 days for their emergency need to be met. So those are the things that credit unions, I think, are uniquely positioned to provide that service, but not just to bring that member in for the one loan, but to bring them up to more graduated products. And again, making sure they have the resources to have access to full financial inclusion and shared prosperity.
Oh, I think that's fantastic. I'd like to move on to the leadership and the life hacks portion of the show. I was interested to ask you these questions because you've had quite the career. But to start with, becoming the chairman of the NCUA, what inspired you to accept that position?
You know what? That's a question that I often get. And as you know, I've been in banking for quite a while. I was working for one of the largest banks in the world before being tapped to come to NCUA, where I was doing a lot of the work around helping underserved and marginalized communities. And what allowed me, or what prompted me to leave a Wall Street firm, was at NCUA, I get to effectuate change on a broad level around policies, procedures, initiatives that, again, dovetail with my passion of helping the vulnerable and the least among us, as they mentioned in the scriptures. So, yes, I got to do that for a large Wall Street firm. But the fact that now I get to touch one third of the American people with bringing them hope, inspiration, but more importantly, access to affordable financial services.
You mentioned you were there a decade ago, also at the NCUA. How is the inspiration different now that you're the chairman?
The inspiration is different now because as chairman, I didn't realize this a decade ago when I was vice chairman, but as the chairman of this agency who really serves as the primary spokesperson, I'm the one that represents NCUA before meetings at Treasury, where I serve on the Financial Stabilization Oversight Council. I also serve as vice chairman of all the other regulatory bodies, and that's called FIFIAC, the Federal Financial Institutions Examination Council. So because of my role as chair, I am working in tandem and in collaboration with the other financial regulators who all, believe it or not, like me, we are very passionate about making a difference, and we all have financial inclusion as something that we want to promote and enhance. Whether you talk to me at NCUA or Yelena McWilliams from the FDIC or Joseph Audie from the OCC, we're all working on initiatives that will really promote economic prosperity and underserved communities. So that's the thing that I really value as chairman. I will say that the chairman does stay a little busier than I ever imagined. And I am, as you've already said, I'm a little unique in my chairmanship is that I want to go around the United States and touch credit unions. I can't touch all 119 million members, but I sure as heck can try to touch all 50 states where they reside. That means meeting with the credit unions, the leagues, and also meeting with some of the state regulators because they play a pivotal role in keeping our system safe and sound as well. So I love the fact that I now am getting, again, the ability to effectuate change in tandem with my fellow board members and wonderful, dedicated, and capable career staff here at the agency.
Oh, that's fantastic. It has been great seeing you around the, you know, the past year since you came on 8 months ago at quite a few of the events. Both of us are racking up all kinds of airline miles.
But I just know that what's racking up is opportunities to interface with the credit union ecosystem.
Absolutely. That's fantastic. How would you describe your leadership style? You mentioned you have a great team there.
I have a really good team, and I am so blessed to have them, both the team that gets to serve me as chairman of the agency, but also the overall staff as well. So I oversee 1,185 individuals. That means that when I get up in the morning, I'm not just working for myself, but I'm working to make sure that I protect this agency, that I protect this insurance share fund. When you look at it this way, there are 1,185 people that I'm responsible for that have mortgage payments, rent payments, kids that send to school, auto payments. I want to make sure that I am giving them the environment where they can work and bring their true, authentic selves to this workplace each and every day. And Randy, I would say that because I was a missionary in Africa, because I want to do the work that allows me to give back and empower individuals, I would say that my leadership style is one of servant leadership. I believe firmly in empowering those that I work with, not as overseer, but as one who empowers them to reach their potential, to not micromanage. But if there is a deficiency, not how do I play gotcha, but how do I say, why don't we get you some additional training for the skills and things of that nature? In fact, we had an employee here when I first came on board as chairman who, because I am a little bit more visible than other chairmen, I guess recently, I'm out and about with different events and I wanted to show stakeholder engagement, where the young lady did not really know a lot about photography, but she wanted to take a lot of pictures of me and to use them for some of our media posts. Well, I would sometimes have an ear cut off or something like that. And I wanted to meet with her and she was wondering, oh my gosh, am I in trouble? I said, no, you're not in trouble. Why don't we send you to photography school? Why don't we get you some ongoing education and things of that nature? So to me, it was a chance where I think another boss who didn't practice servant leadership would have played gotcha. I was like, no, you have a heart that wants to serve. She wanted to really do the right thing. So we were able to get her the training. And in fact, I would just say that if I have a quote, and that is, leadership is not really an affair of the head. It really, to me, is an affair of the heart. And that shows for me, I try to make decisions with passion, compassion, and empathy all at the same time.
You sound like a servant leader, that's for sure. So you mentioned missionary work in Africa. I was just in Kenya. I had the opportunity twice this year to actually go, or this past year, to work with a Costco over there. I was blown away. It was just like something I felt. It was amazing. So
I was there living at the time as a short-term missionary in Zambia and Zimbabwe.
Okay.
But when I was here at the agency a decade ago, I had the honor of representing NCUA at a United Nations Forum in Kenya. We were there in Nairobi. So it was actually lovely being able to interface with the folks in Kibera. And Kibera is probably one of the most low to moderate income communities in the world. And we were able to there talk about hope and financial inclusion and a lot of the things that we're still focusing on today.
I was amazed that, I mean, they're doing such amazing work on the continent. And yet when it comes down to it, we're all very similar, right? Like it's the same motivation, the same. So it was an amazing experience.
I enjoyed it as much as I did.
Oh, very much so. Is there something that your team at the NCUA has heard you say so many times they can finish your sentence?
Regulation needs to be effective and not excessive.
.. So sometimes as a leader, and this was a new question that I really wanted to work in for season two, and a lot of these come as scratch my own itch questions, but sometimes as the leader, you have to make that tough decision that's not always popular in the short term. Is there something for other leaders out there that you've done to cultivate that ability to do that in yourself?
Yes, well, I try to find common ground when it's possible. As we may have talked a little bit earlier, I try to use humility and empathy and compassion when making decisions. But there are times when you still have to make that decision that may not sit well with stakeholders or with employees. One of those moments when I was a young leader at a firm, at a Wall Street firm, in fact, where the department was being shuttered. It was going to really be, the department was going to be folded into a different area. And with that, there were going to be jobs that were shifted to either different areas of the country or some perhaps eliminated. But I had to sit down with my star performers and tell them through no fault of their own that their jobs were being shifted or moved into different areas of the organization. And that was bad news. These are folks that had just, oddly enough, had just come to work with me. And then a year later, company's priorities shift. So I was able to aligned their priorities and expectations and was able to get them into new roles within the organization. Some had to go to outside the company, and I was able to sort of be a reference or a resource to help them navigate those waters. And that was hard when people were thinking they're not going to have the ability to make their payments on their cars and mortgages. But for me to tell that decision to them with compassion, with honor, and the fact that this is now over, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, and these folks are now among my best friends.
That means you did it well. Is there a myth about good leaders that you would like to debunk, or leadership in general?
Yes. I would like for folks to realize that the leader is not necessarily the smartest person in the room.
I've heard others say the leader is the one who surrounds themselves with the smartest people in the room. So
my job effectively, I can't be able, I don't have the wherewithal to really oversee all 119 million people by myself. I don't have the ability to really do a lot of the things that the credit union ecosystem needs to have done every day to succeed, to grow, thrive, and prosper. I like bringing in good, strong talent with diversity, with different viewpoints, so we're not at all subject to groupthink. And again, it takes, I think, someone that's a mature servant leader who is confident enough in his or her abilities to know that it's all right to hire that person that has that PhD in this arcane area that's going to help you really get your job done. And it really is difficult for folks to recognize that. But no, I have surrounded myself with my immediate team that you've seen me bring on board recently. These are all folks that are the best and brightest in government services. And I want them to have rewarding careers here, as I do for the other 1,180 employees of the agency.
You mentioned right there, like mature servant leader. Is there a mistake that you made when you were younger, or one that you see young leaders make often?
Oh my gosh. I think that you wanted to discuss this. And if I could go back and reverse the hands of time, it is when I was young and building my career and starting out as a, and as you know, in banking financial services, you start out as a financial analyst and then you become a senior analyst. And the whole trajectory is really, are you analyzing deals? Are you making strategic investments? And of course, I did decide to focus on community development. So I was still focusing on those areas that I care about. But the area that I want to crawl under a rock is those moments when I had FaceTime with some of the most senior people in the room. And rather than talk about family and their children and what their pursuits were, it was letting them know how bright I was and that I had memorized the annual report, that I knew the quick ratios, that I knew asset recoveries, days on hand, all the things were like, oh my gosh. So again, when you're young, you're like letting them know everything that you know. And with maturity, you don't need to let everyone know that you're a walking encyclopedia of the industry sector that you were covering at the time. And that's something that I do think young people sometimes feel, that when they are talking with anyone that's at a leadership role, look how great I am. Aren't you glad that I work for you? And now, as I've morphed and grown, it's now let's use that time at any time to get to know the person as an individual. With many of the institutions where most of our folks work in credit unions or in banking or wherever the case may be, if you're at a great institution, we already know that you're smart. You don't have to impress us with what's on your CV. Impress us with what I would call the soft skills. Don't show me your IQ. Show me your EQ.
Absolutely. Daniel Goleman book, Emotional Intelligence, right? Has there been a piece of advice or a life lesson that you received early that you've just held with you all the way, you know, through your career?
Ooh, yes. And that is from just always being like the one that likes to prepare and always sort of know what's going on. And that is proper preparation and planning prevent poor performance.
There you go. You know, something I noticed again from the first season of the podcast were how many people mentioned mentors. And, you know, I from your servant leadership style, my guess is that you've been a mentor to many, but I would ask you the question, did you have mentors coming up and how did they shape the leader you are today?
I have been blessed and fortunate to have had mentors along the way, starting out my career. And people need to realize mentors are not just there to advance your career, but they are there to give you advice and to help you understand how to navigate your career opportunities. My person that I've worked with for years is a general out of North Carolina. We met, believe it or not, when I was a young banker, and he in turn left the military and went on to become a board member of a bank, a board member of an aerospace company, And he's gone on to become a professional board member. But he is the one that has taught me about the significance of relationship building, of also keeping your skills fresh and honed. Don't just rest on the knowledge base you have today, but stay abreast of what are some of the new emerging issues. So for me, it's, okay, what's going on with blockchain? What's going on with Libra and things of that nature? So what General Walls taught me is the importance of always taking an opportunity to learn, to grow. There was an opportunity where I was being considered for a job opportunity that I had to throw my name in the hat. And the general, I talked to him, I said, I'm not going to apply. I said, the people who are going to be applying for that job have been in the industry 15, 20 years longer than my 10 years. And I said, I'm not going to do it. There's no way they're going to select me. And so you are afraid to put your name in the hat, he said, because someone may have 10, 15, 20 years longer experience than you, and you don't think you will be qualified. That's it precisely. It tells me that they've been doing the same thing for such a long time that they won't have any fresh ideas or any ingenuity to bring. I went into the interview with that confidence, and I later was taken on a national role where I became the head of national affordable lending for a large organization because I went in with that mindset. So that's how the mentor really forced me, got me out of my comfort zone. And again, with mentoring comes really good advice if he or she who gets it chooses to listen and adhere it.
Now that you've had more experience, is that important for you to pass that along to others? Is that something that you actively do?
I certainly do, Randy. In fact, I look forward to those opportunities in a number of fronts. I do a lot of it informally. If I'm ever giving a speech, especially with the credit unions, I know they're really good about bringing their interns or some of the younger people who have just started with their training programs. I take an interest in sitting down with those people and walking them through some lessons that I've learned along the way to prepare them to say that if you ever see me, don't impress me with your encyclopedic knowledge, but let's get to know each other. So I do try to mentor a lot of folks and give them guidance. But I also had an experience probably about 7 years ago where I went to a conference sponsored by Gallup, the organization here in Washington. They do a lot of great research. And then there was a young man that sort of said, hey, sir, is that seat taken? I said, no, you're welcome to sit there. So then we go through the program and we're asking questions of the plenary speakers. And then he goes, well, now, what do you do? And I talked about my work and corporate responsibility. And then he goes, well, may I get your card? And I said, of course you may. And he was a young senior at one of the colleges here in D.C. So he wanted to come to the office and meet for coffee. And then he came by and we talked about his career opportunities. And he's one of these that I wasn't going to call it a mentoring relationship, but he wouldn't leave. Meaning he finished the coffee and then it became, now, can you tell me about this? And how should I do this? And I took the role of maybe quasi father figure, mentoring figure. And to the point now that I'm very proud to say that he's now gotten married. I was there with him when he got married to a childhood sweetheart. He's now started a family, and we still to this day still keep in touch. Where I talk to him about how does he navigate working with corporations as he builds his enterprise. He has a foundation that serves at-risk youth, and he's using sports and outreach to take these gifted athletes who may not have thought about academics, but when you pair it with academics where they can get scholarships to go to college and things like that. So this mentoring relationship that became informally over serendipitously sitting beside him at a conference to inviting him to my office to the fact that when I say he wouldn't leave, it was like, well, okay, we've talked for about an hour now. He's like, well, do you have more time? And again, it's easy for me to say I care about mentoring and give it lip service, but how do you show you care? You show it with that investment in time.
Absolutely.
So I try to invest time in this young man, and I'm sort of enjoying watching him grow and navigate.
I can imagine. That's pretty cool over the long term there to watch the whole progression of life along the way. So
now they're bringing on a new life.
Absolutely, yeah. So if you have a free day, nothing on the calendar, I know that does not happen often. You take off the chairman hat. What are your passions outside of credit unions? What do you do to recharge?
What do I do to recharge the battery? That's a really good question. Well, first and foremost, I love spinning or cycling. So I am a huge fan of spinning classes. It's a great way to keep you in shape and it motivates me. I love working out. I try to work out 6 days a week for about 75 minutes a day.
Okay.
So my day often begins with getting up between 5:15 and 5:30 to get the spinning class in, to get the lifting in, to walk a few miles, to do my daily devotion. When I'm not doing those things, so that's how I start today. And if I have a day, which I don't have anything in their schedule, which is very rare. I think Sundays for me tend to be free, but most of the days in this job, which I love, I'm thinking about regulatory relief. I'm thinking about opportunities to further financial inclusion. So I do spend a lot of time getting to think about strategic things. And when I'm not doing that, I love the opera. I just recently went to the opera in Washington, where I got to see one of my favorite productions. I got a chance to see Othello. The 2 weeks before that, I was able to go see Magic Flute. So I try to do things with the arts. But more importantly, I try to spend time with friends. I mean, when you're working as much as I am, especially in the public eye, it's sometimes nice just to enjoy your friends, to have a small, intimate dinner, see a movie, and things like that. But I try to be well-rounded as much as I can.
I love it. I'd like to move on, you know, to the third part of the show. They're the rapid fire questions. The questions are rapid. Your answers do not have to be. So what was a young Rodney Hood like in high school?
Very outgoing, I was voted most studious, most likely to succeed on the debate team, president of the Honor Society, but unique in that while I had like that group, I had a different group. So I was the one that, and you don't see this in high schools today, where you could be president of the Honor Society, but yet still hang out with the cool kids. So I was one that, because of being able to build relationships, I was able to work hard and study harder.
And you, it sounds like you always were able to connect with people.
Connecting with people is always a better thing. So I was always like the outgoing, bubbly person that always cared.
You kind of mentioned it, but this is your second go around with credit unions. One of the things that became a common theme in the first season of the podcast as well is most of us stumbled into this industry in one way or another. We didn't grow up going, I want to work in credit unions. So, and then we get here and we're like, we absolutely can't imagine not working in the industry. So what was your path the first time around to credit unions?
It was really interesting because if you had told me at age 22 that a couple of decades later, I would be chair of the Federal Financial Regulatory Agency that I oversee today, I would not have believed you. But then again, there's an awful lot, Randy, in my career path that was a surprise even to me. I did not set out to dedicate my life to work in financial services. In fact, I've always had a career desire to maybe work as a priest. I did spend some early days after college as a missionary, as we mentioned, living in Zambia and Zimbabwe. But as it turned out, God had other plans for me. But that call to service, I felt as a young man, did not point me directly to the priesthood. I did not have to be a minister to do the work that I now get to do today. So once I embarked upon my banking career, I still saw my mission in simple terms. It was about people helping people and people serving people. And I must say, when I started doing this, it was well before I was introduced to the credit union ethos of people helping people. So again, it was almost like through providence that I now get to bring all of my aspirations and it matches with my vocation and things like that. So when I made that fundamental connection, I realized that there is very little distance between missionary work and the mission of finance. The connection between the two, again, is service to others. So that's what steered me into the path for broader financial services. And I think that's what undergirds the work I get to do now as chairman of NCUA.
You mentioned getting your morning workout in. I love asking the question, is there a daily routine that you have that if you don't do it, your day just feels off? Is it the workout or?
Well, it's a combination thereof. I get up. The first thing I do once that 5:15 alarm goes off, I do my daily devotion. And then I get dressed to go to the gym. And then if I don't go to the gym, I'll just do a workout at home. But those are the things that I want devotion and my workout routine to be as sacrosanct to me as when we all brush and floss. I'm looking at that as just critically important for the day and for me to be centered and grounded and I think tethered to reality. So the day-to-day routine is doing the devotion, the workout routine, and then normally around 7:30, that's when it's time to maybe start looking at emails to see if what's going on in the financial markets, what's going on in the credit union industry, what are some of the newspaper articles that don't involve me that I need to address and things like that.
If you don't mind me asking, when you talk about your devotion, is that something you sit with? Is it something you read? Is it something you write down?
Oh, really good question. It's something that I read. There is a book that I've been using called My Utmost for His Highest by the great theologian Oswald Chambers. And again, the name of it is My Utmost for His Highest. And it has you a different day with a scripture and a devotion to help center your mind as you meditate. And this is something that really buoys me as I do my walk and run and then get ready for the spinning class.
Everybody who's listened to the podcast know I journal first thing every morning. And it also, if I take the time to meditate and take the time to journal, I feel like I can just conquer anything. I do it first thing before emails or anything else. So this is a new question that I added for the second season. Is there an app or a tool that you just couldn't live without? And since, you know, you're the first on this season, an old school planner, a calendar, I use Evernote I'm looking at my questions. Do you want Evernote right now?
So. Oh my goodness. Sadly, because of technology, I have become quite addicted to MapQuest because it's so helpful either when I'm driving or in some instances when I'm walking. As you know, with my new job as chairman, I am traveling around the country and you often find yourself in a city that you don't know, but you don't want to take a taxi. You may want to walk. You may want to do a run. So I find myself constantly using the MapQuest and hitting the walking app so I can know where I'm going.
I do the same thing. When I first started CU Insight and started traveling more around the country, I found myself in cities, like you said, that you don't know, and I didn't want to just sit in the hotel room. So the Google Maps, right? The random question, what's the best album of all time? That one you can listen to without skipping a song.
Oh, of course, you should know the answer to that. Paul Simon, Graceland.
There you go. I think you're the first person to mention that one, but we're going to make a huge Spotify playlist that everybody can listen
to.
That
is absolutely amazing. I mean, let's think about African rhythm, Paul Simon being there with some of the African choirs.
Yeah.
The music, it resonates. It's just as melodious to spirit and ear and soul today as it was when I listened to it through college.
It's a fantastic album. I'm a reader. Jill and I have a stack of books in our house, and a lot have come from people recommending them to us. Is there a book that you've either gifted over time or that you just think everybody should read?
You know what? I love good literature. I love well-crafted literature. I'm one that loves the beauty of sentences. A book that I recently read was Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towle. He also wrote another book that I love called The Rules of Civility. He is what I would call a modern day version of Henry James.
I have not read him. And yesterday I was looking at one of those, like the five books Bill Gates says you have to read. And I think that Gentleman in Moscow was on there. It was the first
time. It's a beautiful book. The sentence structure is lovely. It's captivating. It takes you back into the Soviet Union. And it's the life of a prince who is held hostage in a hotel. And it talks about his befriending some of the locals in the hotel and his day-to-day routine. So it's a beautiful book. And also The Rules of Civility, also written by Amor Towle, who, by the way, is a recovering banker who's now a writer. And again, I would call him the modern day version of Henry James. And because I am a bit of an Anglophile, there is also a piece of literature that I love in any format, and that's the late writer P.G. Woodhouse. I'm a huge fan of Jeeves and Wooster. So P.G. Woodhouse is just things that you want for comic relief. It's just all of the antics of this young Englishman and his valet as they travel around the countryside, getting in and out of mischief.
Well, you just added to my stack of books. So I will be going to Amazon as soon as we're done. As you've gotten older, what has become more important to you? And I absolutely love the flip side of this. What's become less important?
What's become more important is time, quality time, that is, with close friends and family. The fact that as I've gotten aged, you start going to more than the sheer funerals than you'd like to go to. And you recognize, this time that was frittered away because you were so busy doing other things that you would assume that these family members and friends would still be around. And that's something that to me now, as I talked about my routine and the workout, also spending time for friends, I try to make sure that I'm calling a friend. I'm very old-fashioned. I try to call friends and family members. And that to me, as I've gotten older, is critically important because we don't know what our days are on this earth.
The flip side, what's become less important?
What's become less important to me is fluff. And when I call that, I think I used to measure a great weekend as if you've gone to like some huge cocktail party in your neighborhood and you've met like 50 neighbors and but then you get home, you're like, you don't remember anything you said. You barely remember the name, but you had a wide tent or a wide net, but you don't come home fulfilled. Now going back, it's dinner parties of no more than six or eight, where you're at someone's home, where you all are cooking the meal together, you're all having a wonderful time, and you're having deep conversations around issues that matter.
True relationships, right? So there is a question that I don't send. When you hear the word success, who's the first person that comes to mind?
Oh my gosh, that is such a huge question, because success is what you choose to do with the gifts that you've been given.
It's my favorite question because we all define success differently, right?
So I define it by people who have taken their tools, who have used them constructively, creatively to effectuate change and to make a difference. I am going to say that the credit union member is my ideal of success, because they took the options that they had to get served by financial services, and they chose the option that was going to be affordable for them, where they would have a membership cooperative looking after their needs.
Well done. Thank you again, Chairman Hood, for taking your time out of what I know is a busy schedule to be on the show. The last question that I have for you is, do you have any final asks of our listeners or any final thoughts you'd like to share?
The final thoughts I'd like to share with you all is I hope you can glean a little bit more insight about me, Rodney Hood, the chairman of NCUA, through the time that I've spent with Randy this afternoon. I hope you know that I'm passionate about making a difference in the lives of the 119 million people who really want to have a credit union that they can belong to and get access to affordable financial services. I hope you know that I'm committed to keeping our agency safe and strong so that our employees can feel empowered to reach their full-term potential. I hope you know that I also want to give back to the local community by volunteering at Rather Be My Church and other nonprofits that really, at the end of the day, are helping make America better than when we entered this world. And I just want you to know that I hope that I get to see many of you who are listening to this podcast when we're out and about. And if you have listened to it and I see you out, please say, hey, we heard your podcast. I can know that at least I touched one person. But other than that, I wish you all and your families a safe and glorious new year.
I appreciate it, sir. We will link to everything we talked about today in the show notes. If people have additional questions of you, I know you're on LinkedIn. Is there you're also on Twitter. Is there a preferred way that they should shoot you a message?
Or just on our ncua.gov website. It also has the chairman's portal that way to let me know questions. And again, I love getting feedback and hearing insight.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much again for taking the time. I hope you have an amazing 2020, and I look forward to seeing and talking to you soon.
Same here. Thank you. And thank you for your time. I was honored to be on your show.
Thank you, sir. A few more things before we go. I would once again like to thank Chairman Hood for taking the time out of his busy schedule to have this conversation today. And also a big thank you to our sponsor, Co-op Financial Services. Make sure to click on their link in the show notes and see everything they have going on. Also, if you missed it at the end of last year, you asked for it, so we made it for you. You can Google the CU Insight Experience podcast book list, or you can find a link to it in the show notes as well, and you'll be able to find a list of every book that every single guest has mentioned on the podcast. We will keep that list running with links to Amazon where you can go out and buy it. So happy reading and have a great day.